leave, still leaving right action behind. And right effort is very interesting. I mentioned it to someone before coming down here today that I was going to talk about right effort, and the person said, "Oh, that's tricky." So, right effort. And so I don't know how to tie this into the little exercise we did, if that was interesting for you. But just to kind of say something about thoughts. I sometimes say, you know, probably many of you have heard it from me a number of times, this very, very, very cute thing that happens in when the mind gets very silent in meditation. The mind can be very, very quiet. And then you can have this thought that says, "Oh, I'm not thinking at all right now." And it's more amazing because at that very moment you believe it. You don't notice that you had this thought that "I'm not thinking." And so that, you know, that's one part. But if you look very carefully, especially when the mind is very, very quiet, at how we know anything, at how we are aware, how we, you see the role of thinking and thoughts in our awareness of what's going on. And if you're aware that there's something more to who we are than our thinking, and there's something, and we're here, and there's experience here, even without thinking, without thoughts and without words. However, if, as soon as you try to be aware of that, it's almost like immediately there's a label or a word or a concept or a thought that comes into play. So it's like if you try to experience it without the filter of thoughts, it's like it's like, you know, trying to touch your elbow with your right elbow with your right hand. It's there, but you know it's there, but it's kind of hard. You can't quite get to it, and it's kind of an amazing thing to kind of ride the edge between the world of thinking and the world of non-thinking, and see if you can kind of hover there in that edge. And what I feel in that place, the preciousness of, there's something very precious and vulnerable about that interface or that gap or that area of our existence. And what I feel often is kind of tremendous preciousness, that there's a vitality, there's life energy that's present. And it feels more vulnerable, more alive, or more juicy, or more interesting, or more perplexing, or more, I don't know what. If I explore that gap between, you know, thinking and not thinking. And in that gap, you know, to be alive and to have life energy flowing through us is really a phenomenally precious thing. It's one of the most, you know, it's amazing that such a thing exists in the universe. And so many of us, I believe, really do center our center of our universe, the way we reference the world around us and the world within us, is through our thoughts, through our thinking. And it's kind of like we live in this bubble of thinking machine, that everything else gets related and seen through that. And our thoughts, you know, have all kinds of different kinds of content. And then we start to believe the content of our thoughts. And then it isn't just simply we live in this bubble, but we live in this colored bubble. Someone said that beliefs are the hardening of the arteries of the mind. And because beliefs are hardened thoughts. You know, you have a thought and you've done something with it, you've grasped onto it, you've held onto it, you've fixated on it. But you know, where is the center of our life? Where's the center of the universe in the world of our experience? And I think the only place that we can possibly say the center of the universe, if the universe is our experience, is the seat of our life energy, the seat of our awareness. To find ourselves, to feel at rest and at home at this place right here, is the center of the universe, without getting arrogant about it. This is it. I mean, each of you, you know, you have your own sphere. Everything else kind of arises out of that life force, that life vitality, that awareness that is you at this particular moment. And if that becomes a little bit more a sense of the reference, if we don't lose too much touch with that by getting lost in our thoughts and our concerns, I think we start feeling the preciousness, the delight of being alive. And I think all of us, I'm sure all of us, know what it's like to get overly busy, overly stressed, where our endeavoring, our work, our efforts in our life get ahead of ourselves, and we get so caught up in activity, and so caught up in mental concerns and emotional concerns, that the sense of the centeredness, the sense of this being the center of where the whole universe arises and passes, gets lost. This might be a non sequitur, but I'm thinking now of a Zen story. Someone asks a Zen monk, it goes, all things return to the One. Where does the One return to? So that's a good question. Try that one out. And so the monk answered, well, maybe the Palo Alto equivalent of his answer would be, today I went to Whole Foods and got 3 bags of groceries. Now, you know, that's Zen, right? What do you mean? What's the connection between that wonderful philosophical question, where does the One return to, and getting groceries in Whole Foods? There is a way in which what they want to do in Zen is they take the sense of oneness and they take it further in a kind of reconstruction of our life as it is. And the birth of the universe is going to Whole Foods and buying groceries, if that's what you're doing. Getting in your car now and driving home. That's where the One returns to. The One returns to actually what's happening right now, where we find ourselves right now, and all the varied multiplicity of the details of how what's going on right now. So right effort, what does it have to do with right effort? I had to figure that out quickly. Well, I'll get some help. So Suzuki Roshi writes about right effort. The most important point in our practice is to have right or perfect effort. Right effort directed in the right direction is necessary. If your effort is headed in the wrong direction, especially if you are not aware of this, it is deluded effort. Our effort in our practice should be directed from achievement to non-achievement. Usually when you do something, you want to achieve something. You attach to some result. From achievement to non-achievement means to be rid of the unnecessary and bad results of effort. If you do something in the spirit of non-achievement, there is a good quality in it. So just to do something without any particular effort is enough. When you make some special effort to achieve something, some excessive quality, some extra element is involved in it. You should get rid of excessive things. If your practice is good, without being aware of it, you will become proud of your practice. That proud is extra. What you do is good, but something more is added to it. So you should get rid of that something which is extra. This point is very, very important, but usually we are not subtle enough to realize it, and we go in the wrong direction. And he's saying to go in the wrong direction is to make an effort to achieve something. And he's not saying, you know, be completely passive and don't try to, you know, do things. But the point is to do something without the added concern, preoccupation with, oh, I have to achieve something, I have to do this. So to sit in meditation is a kind of thing we do. But can we sit in such a way that we're not trying to achieve something? Can we sit in such a way that it's a non-achievement, but that we don't end up just being blobs on the floor here either? The issue of effort and talking about effort is a multi-layered issue. And so just to use the word, talk about effort without distinguishing different areas, maybe is not so helpful. So, for example, now we talk about sitting meditation. There has to be some effort made to come and sit, to endeavor to sit. And that effort needs to be sustained over time. And there has to be, you have to maintain the inspiration, the motivation to come and the effort, the doing, to create the time and the effort and actually sit down on your cushion to meditate. And then there has to be effort to sit upright. You know, because we don't want to sit here like a blob, or just, we might as well just lay down then, you know, fall asleep. But we sit up here with an upright posture, alert, and that's kind of, there's effort, there's energy in the body there. And if we let go of that, the effort to hold ourselves alert, things aren't going to go very well in our meditation. So we sit with some sense of alertness, some effort there. And then we do things like sometimes we follow our breath. We be with our breath, or be with our body sensations, or be with, you know, different things. And so there's effort there involved there. But what is that effort? And what is wrong effort? And so wrong effort, I think, would be to do that with some gaining idea that if you do this, you'll get something from it. Now, you probably will benefit from doing meditation. And so it's not to deny the benefits of it, but if you're preoccupied and the quality of your effort is entangled with trying to get someplace, trying to achieve something, trying to do something, then you've probably gone down the wrong road. And that what we're trying to do in a kind of sense is find at a certain layer, level of efforting, a non-effort. And a lot of what happens in meditation practice and good practice is letting go of what Suzuki Roshi calls all the extra effort, all the extra sense of achievement and doing and stuff. And this is actually, you know, what a lot of our normal life is like, is there's a lot of extraness, there's a lot of extra achievement and efforting and judgment and expectations and projections and all kinds of things that ideas we have that kind of keep the rounds of samsara running. And then what we're trying to do in meditation is to find a sense of trust, a sense of beingness in ourselves, a sense of trust in just being alive, that we don't have to add all this extra defensiveness and aggressiveness and ambition and goal orientation, and find this very precious thing of just being alive, just being vitally here right now. And in order to do that, you can't try to do that. But it helps a lot if you stop trying everything else. And if you stop trying to judge yourself, you stop trying to get somewhere, you stop trying to avoid your pain, your difficulty, you stop trying to make it all better, but you simply sit here and let go of all the different tryings, all the different efforts, accept the effort to let go of those. And the effort to sit here upright and present and as aware as you can. When we first come and sit down and the mind is scattered, sometimes a tremendous amount of effort needs to be made to bring the mind and the awareness back over and over again, to kind of just come back and come back and come back. But that effort, again, if it's not informed by acceptance, if it's not a sense of allowance, of non-achievement in that, you might get very frustrated, because the mind is really a tricky devil. You know, it's, you know, whatever. So it's out of our control, direct control, what happens to the stability or the restlessness of our mind. But we try our best to come back. And if we don't have any expectation, then it's a lot easier. You'll feel much more at ease. And then with time, as we begin finding yourself more in the present moment, there's this magic that happens, what's called effortless effort. We begin actually feeling that we are present. And the vitality, the energy, the endeavoring is there, but we're not necessarily doing it. It's not something we're applying ourselves to do, but it's kind of like it's happening by itself, it's effortless effort. And it's almost as if there's a kind of effort that's inherent in who we are. And that if all the different strivings and ambitions and judgments and defensiveness and fears and aggressions and angers and all the different things that kind of tie up our mind and our heart, if all those have a chance to not completely go away, but begin to kind of stop having their strong hold on us, that this natural effort will arise within us. And it's really beautiful, I think. You see sometimes in meditation that as we kind of move into this area of effortless effort, sometimes the body by itself will become more erect. And, maybe you've been trying to sit erect for a long time, but suddenly this kind of healthy sense of energy arises within you. And you're not doing it anymore, but it's there. There's effort, there's energy there for it. So to have to bring good effort. So what is that? To be engaged fully. So to be engaged, fully engaged. Really, this is what I'm doing. I'm trying to pay attention. try to wake up my mindfulness the best I can, to really feel, be here and sense my life as it is, to really come back and let this be the center of my universe, to really rest here in the center, have the trust that this can really be the center of your rest. To come back and do that over and over again without adding any kind of sense of ambition, of achievement, of expectations, of judgment, of it needing it to be that way even. Just simply, that's there's this wonderful kind of the vocabulary, the word that's used in Theravada and Buddhism for directing yourself towards liberation is not striving or directing or, you know, kind of doing, but the word is to incline oneself toward liberation. So we incline ourselves. I think that's more a spirit of right effort. Another Zen story. Not a story, it's more like a little biography of the Zen master Dogen. It said he became a monk when he was quite young, and he was he studied hard. And when he was 14, he wasn't a Zen monk, he was a Buddhist monk outside, not in the Zen school. And he'd done all this study of Buddhism, Buddhist texts, and he became perplexed because in the tradition of Buddhism he'd been studying, the teaching was, or is, that we're already Buddha just the way we are. We're already perfect just the way we are. And so then his question was, you know, I don't know if it was maybe, I don't know if it was brilliance or whether it was laziness, but his question was, well, why do I need to practice then? If we're already perfect, why do we need to do anything? And so his teacher then sent him to a Zen master. Said, I can't help you. You have to go to the Zen teacher. And so he did that. And he went to, from Japan to China and studied in China. And in China, he realized an answer to his question when he experienced his liberation. And he wrote about this. And his understanding is that yeah, it's true that we're perfect just the way we are. But If you won't realize that, you won't manifest that, you won't be that, unless you practice. So practice is not in order to get somewhere. Practice is not to get you, you know, anywhere else. But practice is giving yourself a chance to manifest the perfection or the wholeness or the completeness of who we are, nature of who we are. And I think that's a beautiful way to think of practice. It lends itself to this goalless approach to practice. It's not, we're not trying to do something or get anywhere. We're kind of putting ourselves in a situation where we can allow our integrity, our honesty, our awareness to kind of surface, and here we are right now. So this kind of teaching, this kind of approach is hopefully a lot of what you hear from Buddhist teachers is challenging. And it should be challenging in the sense that maybe you do sit with some hope or expectation or some striving or some trying to do something. And so maybe this kind of teaching then makes you kind of reflect, think about, you know, what is the appropriateness of this? Or what am I doing when I meditate and when I practice? What am I trying to achieve? And how can I hold that sense of what I'm trying to do something? Is it necessary to hold that? Or is it a different way of holding it? So is it okay to sit with some sense of achievement, but letting go of all efforts to achieve? You know, it's and in the final, sooner or later in a person's practice, maybe say it this way, that mindfulness practice is self-purifying, in that as we practice, sooner or later it becomes impossible to practice with any sense of goal, with a trying to achievement of getting somewhere, because it just gets in the way. It's like this extra thing. It's like, why do you need anything extra in the way? Why complicate your life with this little extra thought or concern? And maybe sometimes it's not for many years until the practice matures that we see how that gets in the way. Maybe until it gets, until we see it, maybe it's useful even, because it keeps you going and keeps you connected. But the wonderfulness that we discovered in practice is that is really the delight of just being alive and aware and here, and that just to come back to that and learning how, and learn how, in a sense, to let go of all the forces of the mind that get in the way. And if we can't let go of them, then learn to appreciate them, learn to not to struggle against them, learn to just to be without all the externness. I think it's much better to talk about practice as letting go of all the externness than it is to talk about, you know, maybe some wonderful kind of state that we can reach. Because life is not always wonderful. Sometimes it's quite difficult. And that's what life is also. Isn't that wonderful? kind of. Sometimes, you know, I meet with people, and there's all kinds of people, you know, just people, friends and family or whatever. And sometimes there's a lot of pain. And sometimes, you know, I really wish the pain, you know, I always don't want people to feel pain. But sometimes it doesn't seem inappropriate to feel pain. Someone's died and people feel heartbroken. And it doesn't seem appropriate to try to take away that pain. There's something precious about that pain, even though I wish it to be different. I wish it didn't happen and all that. But there's something about this life there also. When the Theravadin tradition talks about the Eightfold Path and they get to the right effort, they will distinguish four kinds of right efforts. And I just add this as a footnote so you kind of to be maybe partly in terms of thoroughness. One is, there's four right efforts. One effort is to maintain wholesome states of mind that have already arisen, that are here and present. So if you're feeling peaceful or happy or generous or compassionate, to, in a some appropriate way, maintain and support that. That's considered right effort. The second right effort is the effort to let go of unwholesome states of mind that have arisen, that are present right now. So if you're angry or upset, in an appropriate way, learning how to let go of that. The third is to, right effort, is the effort to bring about wholesome states of mind and heart that are not present right now. So to get them to arise. And the fourth right effort is to keep those unwholesome states of mind which have not arisen yet from arising. And there's a lot of wisdom to be explored in those four right efforts. You know, it's very practical sometimes. For example, you know, if you're obsessing about what? About what's a good thing to obsess about?
Whether to go to Whole Foods or not.
Whether to go to Whole Foods or not. So, you know, so you're addicted to those corn chips they sell at Whole Foods, right? And you know, and your mind gets all in a tight, you know, narrow and contracted state when you ever get close to the smell of corn chips at Whole Foods. And perhaps you know, a healthy effort is to avoid Whole Foods, you know, so that kind of state doesn't arise. Now that's kind of a silly example, but there's other much better, painful examples. People who, you know, addicted to alcohol or to drugs or to sex or to money or almost any kind of addiction. Sometimes it's very wise to do the effort to help prevent those states from arising by avoiding certain places or people or whatever. So it's just practical good advice, these four right efforts. However, another way of seeing these four right efforts is just what I've been talking about so far, is that all four of those are achieved by discovering the effort which doesn't try to achieve anything. The non-achievement of effort, the letting go of agendas, of trying to make something happen, simply allowing ourselves to rest and trust ourselves in the present moment as it is, opens a whole wonderful world. And as we do that, those wholesome states of mind that are present will become strengthened for the most part. unwholesome states of mind which are present will, on their own, will vanish. Not automatically, it takes their time, but and certain wholesome states of mind which are not present will arise, and certain unwholesome states of mind which are not present will not arise if we're simply doing this effort to be mindful in the present moment. The last thing I'll say about effort is that effort. So there's a whole series of efforts. You know, there's the effort to sit every day, to make that effort, which is not an easy thing to do at times. Then there's the effort to actually sit still, to sit upright. There's the effort to bring the mind back into the present moment, to bring the mind to the breath. And then as we kind of get into the more subtle layers of effort, the efforting is a natural function of the mind. And effort is not something you have to do. And it's a wonderful thing, kind of wonderful quality, that it can be sensed when there's effort to be mindful, and the effort to be mindful is kind of flowing clearly by itself. You can kind of sense what that effort feels like in the brain, in the body, and whatever. And it's not tiring, it's not strainful. It's just kind of this, I don't know how to describe it. Effort is a beautiful thing. So to study effort, to study the quality of effort is a very important aspect of practice. What is the quality of the effort, the engagement, the endeavoring, the participation that you've put yourself into when you practice? Is the quality of the effort hesitant, slackful, weak, or is the quality of the effort tight and striving and straining, or is it balanced? The classic example of the right balance of effort is a well-tuned lute. If the strings of the lute are too tight, I guess it'll snap. It makes terrible sound. And if it's too loose, it's terrible sound also. You have to have a just right tautness to make beautiful music. And the effort is, in a sense, to find that balance of effort which is neither too taut or too slack, but makes beautiful music. So, your turn. What do you think of that? Yes?
I was thinking that Jung said something that might be appropriate. He said that in any creative activity, you should exert your mind, your conscious mind, to the utmost until you've done everything you can, and then let go, and your unconscious will give you the answer. And it sounds like the extreme effort is a kind of a koan here. You struggle with it until you can't solve it, and you let go of your mind and that creative force that is always solving problems, whether we realize it or not, is there, can be seen then.
I think that's nice. The only thing is, again, the quality of the effort is very important. And if we're getting tired from the efforting, then maybe it's too much. It can be too much effort, but it's just total engagement in a balanced way. You know, to really, really be here. So one of the things to ask ourselves, when we sit down, am I really going to be here when I sit? Am I really here? Where am I? Am I at work still? Or am I in some conversation with someone? Is that where really I am? I'm at? And find out where you're really at, and then be there. Now, don't sense be in your memories of the work, but don't try to be different in a different place. Try to make a unity of where direction of your mind and your body. So the body and your mind are in the same place. Yes.
I had a really interesting experience when we were sitting, and you gave us instructions. Kind of what I did was I just turned off the mental notation that's usually going on, and it was one of the most amazing experiences I've had while meditating in a year and a half, because I did feel like I was more aware of what was happening in my body. I was at that kind of line, and at times I thought, oh, am I thinking? I think I'm thinking, but, you know, I just kind of, then I just let it go again, because, yeah, I'm thinking, but I'm not, there's not these words, it was the words that, so in some ways I felt I was more present than I've ever been. My question is, you that time said that people who do the notation perhaps progress faster than people who don't. What occurred to me was that given the way my mind goes, you know, fast anyway, that maybe for me the notation is not is too overt or something.
Right.
I don't know, but I just was wondering what is which kind of state is what you're looking for.
I think
trying to strive for anything.
I think that you can experiment. You might try sometime doing this new way and seeing how that is for you. And if it does, if the mind tends to drift off too much and you can't stay present, then maybe you want to bring back the mental noting and to help you there. And what happens for a lot of people is that the mental noting is used up to a certain point. And when you recognize a certain point has arrived where you actually can stay present without the little aid, the help of the mental noting, then you can let go of that. But then you have to stay vigilant, because it's very easy then to kind of space out.
Yeah, I don't think I could have been there without the first 35 minutes of calming the mind and focusing.
So have fun with it. Why don't you, you know, sit for a certain length of time and then let go of the noting and enjoy. Yes?
I wanted to thank you for talking about the center of the universe conversation. I remember when I was a little girl, I went through a period of time where I was asking myself and asking the adults around me, how is this for you, that you're the center of your universe? And I couldn't get an answer, nor could I explain it in any way what I was talking about. And as I grew up, I began to hear from other adults that somehow this noticing being the center of my universe was somehow selfish, you know, it was somehow narcissistic and not a good thing. And it wasn't until I heard you just say what you did about the center of the universe that it made sense to me, and I was able to really hear some words that spoke about it.
Beautiful. That's, and thank you for sharing that. There is a danger of being self-centered there, but it doesn't come automatically, and it's really only possible to be healthfully selfless if we find the center here. If we don't have the center of the universe here, then any kind of selflessness, it will be dangerous.
Without making a rule about it, I wonder, when I look at my experience as a child, if there isn't a way somehow that children have access to that, that noticing, or that sense of being grounded in as the center of the universe.
I think so. My impression is that a lot of children have some experience, and they often will have different words on it, depending on different, you know, whatever. And a lot of children will have some experience of great wholeness, and then they either lose touch with it or forget about it. What happens to some people I know, it happened to me, that certain experiences I had as a child were then remembered when I started meditating. And I remember that. And it would be completely, you know. And so it's like a kind of reappropriation of something really wonderful from my childhood. And the biography of the Buddha gives example of this. When he was 35, he remembered experience he had when he was 6, and that memory then gave him the door, the suggestion of how to really practice. Holly.
I saw a video of this psychoneurologist or psychopharmacologist who gave a really compelling description of how she's researching neurotransmitters and that they're discovering that they're distributed throughout your entire body, trying to understand how people actually think, process thoughts, and move their body. And they were coming to think perhaps that it's really a group illusion, that it's processed in your head, and that actually your entire body is sensing, thinking, your toe is sending you messages, and it's just an illusion that it's all happening in your head.
Buddhists would have no problem with that. they finally got it. Bill.
I don't know how germane this is to the conversation. I used to, as part of my living, I used to design scenery for the stage. And it's a very interesting process because you don't do it alone. It's a group process. But you also, there's an awful lot of input from the author of the play, and then there's a tremendous amount of stuff that you have to do. Like you have to go to the library and look at all these pictures. It was invariably very interesting to me as I look at this in my own mind and how I went about it, is I would go do all of this research and talk to all these people, and then I would have to stop and forget about the whole thing. Just I had to know all of this stuff and learn all of this stuff and really make an effort and spend a lot of hours doing research. And then I had to forget about it. And I found that it was very interesting. I would be riding my bicycle or sitting in the bathroom, and suddenly what I needed to do in terms of the design would just come full blown into my head without... but I found if I worried about it and I have to get it done by this time and there's a deadline and there's always a deadline, if I focused on that, I was dead in the water. It was never going to happen. But if I just let it go and forgot about it, that the whole thing would just come up into my mind, and then I'd have to put it down on paper. But that there's the idea of effort and no effort there, and the appropriateness of when to put the effort in.
Zen,
it's a very hard thing to learn, at least in that context.
If I may, I'll add one thing and then we can end, because it's late now. The Zen Master Dogen, again, he wrote a fascicle where he said that... he talked about how in China a lot of the examples of Zen monks becoming enlightened didn't happen in meditation practice, but they happened outside. Something happened, like they heard a sound or they saw a sight or someone said a word or something, and they kind of, oh... And they were transformed. And he says in this fascicle that this transformation that these people underwent was dependent on the power of their zazen, of their meditation practice. They were fully engaged and totally engaged in their meditation practice, and their liberation didn't come there, but it came because of that full engagement. So it's kind of maybe like what you're describing, Bill, of you're fully engaged in something. You have to be fully engaged. And then something else, you don't know what's going to happen, but something else happens. But it's a result partly of having been fully engaged. So please be engaged.